Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
I'm James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking to Dr. Peter Flurzheim about his new book, Waste and Weapons, Recycling in Britain During the Second World War. This book came out in Cambridge University Press in 2015. Flurzheim's book shows us how wartime recycling exemplified total war. It served as a symbolic link between the material world and society. It helped civilians identify their role in the war and its material demands. Far from boosting morale in the British public, Flurzheim shows us salvage could alienate large sections of the population and destroy invaluable artifacts of British heritage, including archival documents and elements of the built environment for use in weapons production. I hope you have a chance to pick up this book, especially if you're interested in environmental history or the history of the environmental movement. This book shows us recycling's history does not start with the conservation movement of the 1970s, but with the wartime environment of the 1940s. It can show us some valuable lessons on how we approach recycling today, and that problems might remain in how we approach issues of waste and salvage in contemporary life. It was a pleasure to talk to Peter, and I hope you enjoy the show. Thank you. Peter, I'm glad you could be with us today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, James. I'm delighted to be with you.
Great. Let's start about talking about what brought you to environmental history. And more specifically, let's talk about what brought you to Britain in the 20th century in particular.
Well, I've been working in environmental history really since my senior year at Carleton College. And I got into it because I was really interested in connecting contemporary environmental problems to my study of history. And I was particularly drawn to Britain because of its role in early industrialization, urbanization. And I was also involved outside of my work as a history student in environmental activism. And so I put those two things together and became interested in the history of air pollution. And so that's what I started working on really with a senior seminar paper on Victorian Britain as an undergrad. And then as a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I decided to focus my master's and PhD work on the problem of coal smoke in British cities during the 19th and 20th centuries. And I was particularly interested in the cultural aspect of people's understanding of environmental problems and connected that also to technology, to growth of early environmental activist movements. And after I finished that project, I was interested in working more on the 20th century. And I was drawn to World War II, I think, because of just it's such a fulcrum of the 20th century. And obviously, technology played a very important role in that war, but I felt that the environmental impact of the war and really the ways in which resources were so critical to that war really hadn't been looked at very much. So all of the work that I do really tries to integrate environment and technology and modern Britain.
Okay. Yes. It's interesting. Your work is talks a lot about the recycling and how recycled materials were used to make weapons. And did you think that this historiography about Britain and the war focused too much on production and manufacturing and not so much about saving resources and maybe turning them into new materials for the war effort?
Exactly. That was one of the reasons that I decided to write Waste into Weapons. And In fact, I think that historiography has relatively little to say about production either. I think so much of the traditional writing about Britain during the Second World War focuses for good reason on the social and psychological aspects of the home front, enduring the Blitz, particularly during the early period of the war before the United States entered in, the difficulties that Britain faced when much of the continent was under Axis control. And so I think there's a lot of reason that people were drawn to that story, as well as to the traditional military history of the war. But then within the last 20 years or so, I would say there's been an increased attention to the role of technology, the production drive. But a lot of that work didn't really focus very much on the raw materials that went into Britain's war production. And so that's one of the things that I was really trying to address with this book.
Okay. Interestingly, especially for Britain, unlike the United States, Britain does not have an abundance of natural resources. Of course, they had coal and iron, but not really very much else compared to the massive resources of the United States. Did you think that was something, a story that hasn't really been told? Like you wanted to hear it from a story from more or less the have-nots from the haves in your book, and we'll get to it in the podcast. You talk about Lend-Lease and the relationship between the sort of nearly bankrupt UK under bombing and the United States that has all these resources then that they sort of hoard for themselves, that Britain really relied on.
Exactly. Britain was at the heart of a global trading network that developed gradually, but certainly by the time of the First World War, Britain was dependent on imports for not only many of its raw materials, but also for much of its food. And some of these supplies came from relatively short distances on the European continent, but others, of course, came from half a world away. And this worked quite well for the British during peacetime, but once war broke out and there were German submarines sinking British as well as neutral merchant ships, it became much more difficult to obtain materials. And then another very important aspect of this was that as the Axis powers gained control over countries that Britain had relied upon as sources of papermaking material in the case of North Africa or Scandinavia, or natural rubber supplies from the Far East that were under Japanese control, it became really a crisis of immense proportions for the British.
Okay. Well, just talking about the submarine campaign, maybe this would be a good way to segue into chapter one, Salvage in Times of Peace and War. And this chapter really starts with the First World War and what efforts the British made in trying to recycle battlefield scrap for the war effort. Could you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, for a long time, people have been trying to capture enemy weapons on the battlefield or reuse weapons that had been gathered up after people were killed and try to reuse those. And during the First World War, the British, as well as other parties to the conflict, really systematized this effort to try to bring back materials that and you know, weapons, crates, ammunition, even the some of the cases around artillery shells could be refurbished. And so they developed a very extensive system because all countries were overwhelmed by the number of shells that they were firing, the number of guns that were in use. And so the British systematized this within the army and developed an elaborate supply chain stretching back to the UK. In some cases, other materials were refurbished close to the Western Front. And they really perfected a system of trying to recycle materials for the war effort from the battlefield back to the battlefield. And toward the end of the war, they also looked to civilians on the home front as a potential source of materials that could be harvested and put into the war effort. But this happened quite late in the war, and there was a real tension in Britain on a lot of scores about trying to balance fighting the war, but on the other hand, maintaining a quote-unquote business as usual. So there was a real reluctance to upset the apple cart in a dramatic way. And you can see this with Britain was really unique in not having conscription until 1916, whereas most of the other belligerent powers had drafted soldiers from the get-go. And similarly, the British were quite reluctant to institute strong wartime controls over the domestic economy. And so there was a lot of reticence about just how far to push civilians in terms of requiring them to contribute materials that would be used in the war effort. And so the approach generally was quite voluntary, and people were encouraged to collect tin cans or cardboard. There were a few municipalities that suggested cutting down the iron railings and contributing them to the war effort. But none of this went very far on the civilian side, but there were a lot of ideas about what might be done. And one of the things that did happen on the civilian side had to do with paper. And a lot of the paper that was normally thrown away in peacetime was recycled in wartime on the home front in Britain during the First World War in order to make things like cardboard boxes, as well as to replenish the stocks of paper that the wartime government used. And a lot of this paper actually came from government offices at the national as well as the municipal level. And as a result of this, some historical records were actually destroyed, ephemera, local newspapers, and even by some accounts, some of the primary sources for the First World War, records that were only a few months old, once they'd been processed, they were recycled. And this was something that the historians and archivists in the interwar period really bemoaned about the First World War. And some of them were determined to try to have a more cautious approach about what was discarded when the Second War came. But I may be jumping ahead of myself a little bit here.
I mean, one of the most striking parts of your book is to what extent government persuasion and coercion to recycle paper in particular has this effect of getting people to destroy Britain's national heritage as it's being bombed by the Germans. There's all these pushes to, you know, clear out the libraries, clear out the archives. We don't need this anymore. You quote futurist thinkers from the 20s about, oh, well, you know, ignore the past. You know, the future that we're going to build is going to be so great. We don't want to be chained to the past. How did you come to that particular idea? I thought it was really excellent comment on modernity and a comment on sort of becoming modern in the British sense, but while also kind of destroying something that was sort of deeply embedded in British identity.
I was really struck by the paradox that at the same time that the British were trying to defend their lives and their buildings and their libraries against the onslaught of the bombs coming from the air, they were destroying voluntarily some of that same heritage in the name of fighting the war. And so it seemed very puzzling to me, and I was really drawn to it. And I think there's, you mentioned the modernist impulse, and I think that's something that really was running through a large section of British public opinion during the early 20th century. And I think that's something that a number of historians have done an excellent job pointing to, the tensions between tradition and modernity in modern British society. And so I think for some people who really felt weighed down by the past, who felt that Britain was far too traditional and conservative, they had a hostility to things that symbolized the past. And one example of this, which proved to be really central to the war effort, was an ongoing debate about the aesthetic and utilitarian benefits of iron railings, which are such a distinctive characteristic of the urban landscape in Britain, around public buildings, around parks, squares, as well as in front of many private residences. And there were many people in the 1920s, but even going back as early as the 1860s, who criticized iron railings as being a bastion of class privilege, as something that was really trying to ostentatiously present wealth, something that was excluding the poor from access to green space in cities. And there were many people who said they're simply ugly. And many people particularly criticized mass-produced cast iron railings that became an important output of British factories in the 1830s or so. And even if they valued handmade wrought iron railings from the 17th or 18th centuries, they denigrated 19th century railings as a vulgar product of mass industrialism. And so there's this hostility toward that aspect of the built environment. And when the war came, those people who had a long-standing opposition to railings saw the Second World War as a golden opportunity to have an excuse, have a reason to get rid of them. And so running through a lot of that rhetoric is this modernist impulse, as well as an egalitarian impulse. And then in the case of paper and historical records, there is a feeling among some people that really the records of the past, particularly things like ephemeral documents, things that historians today would really value as a window into the cultural and social history of the 18th and 19th centuries, many people in wartime believed that was sort of a luxury that Britain couldn't afford to maintain, and that it really had no purpose anymore. It was simply a bunch of waste paper that was cluttering up the shelves. And so this sort of hostility toward the intellectual or informational content of that paper was really neglected by a lot of people. And so this led to a wholesale clearing out. There were many town and county offices that had large stocks of poor law records and medical relief records and things like that from the 19th century. And they, in many cases, they weren't well looked after. In some cases, they were suffering from mildew, or perhaps mice had gotten in and started to nibble at the edges. And they believed in peacetime that they were required to keep them. In some cases, the law did have requirements that records be kept for a certain amount of time. In private law offices, this was true as well. Many legal offices had records from their clients and past clients going back centuries. And when the war came along, they left it the chance to do something patriotic, as well as to clear out their storerooms of paper. And there were very few people who were raising questions about whether this really was a good idea to toss everything. And so the archivists and the historians who were opposing this really had an uphill battle to fight. And they asserted that actually most of the material, sometimes they asserted that 95% of the documents that were being held could be discarded. But they were really trying to save what they considered to be the most valuable 5%. And in order to do that, they believed they had to sacrifice 95%.
Sure. Yeah. It's interesting in your book, when the law offices and the archives want to get rid of their materials to help the war effort, there also seems to be this idea that there's no more burden anymore, you know, that, you know, these documents are sort of a material burden to a lot of these organizations that they're excited to get rid of. The state has finally said, well, hey, we need your paper. And they say, well, okay, we can give this up. And it's only a relatively small amount of, as you say, archivists and historians that want to defend this stuff. And even at that point, it's a small percentage, and we can only speculate on what has been lost in this endeavor. But
one of the most intriguing things that I discovered in my research were little clues in some computer catalogs and archival databases about some of the materials that had been lost. And I think this is, it's simply the tip of the iceberg, because oftentimes when things are discarded, nobody thinks to keep a record of what it was that was sent away. But one of the things that I included in the book was a detailing of some of the items that are now gone forever because they were given over for the war effort.
Okay, well, let's get back to the text, and we can talk about chapter Persuasion and Its Limits, where you discuss the efforts, the sort of more voluntary efforts that the state asked citizens to recycle for, in particular, women's organizations organizing to help the war effort by collecting salvage, and how the salvage industry, the peacetime salvage industry, sort of is kind of dismissive towards any sort of state or civil or voluntary organization sort of trying to save these materials for the war effort.
Right. So in peacetime, there was a very large and deeply rooted salvage system or recycling system. There were dealers in all manner of materials, and in many societies, things that people wear out or discard don't simply end up in a landfill or in a dump. Other people find a use for them, and so listeners may be quite familiar with contemporary cases where they're in the developing world, there are places where the cast-offs of the wealthy are repurposed and recycled or reused by the poor. And even in industrial societies like the United States and Great Britain, there was a long-standing practice of people going door to door to collect things like rags, bones, broken utensils, and they would find a market for them. And so this existed sort of out of the public eye in some ways. It was not something that was there were in the early 20th century. There weren't municipal recycling programs operated by town or city governments, but there were informal networks of trade, and many people were familiar with what were often referred to in Britain as the rag and bone men, who would make regular rounds in neighborhoods and ask for people to contribute things. And sometimes people would simply give them over, and other times there would be some sort of barter or a small cash payment for things that the junk collectors wanted. And then when the war came along, there was a real conflict between the state's desire to essentially monopolize all of the raw materials in the country versus the continued interest on the part of the scrap trade to maintain its livelihood. And so one of the things that I trace in the book is the sort of ideological debates between whether it was better to have a government-run program or to rely on the private sector to collect materials. And a particular concern of municipal governments was that these private dealers, private collectors, would skim off the most valuable recyclable materials and leave behind things that had less of a monetary value but might be nonetheless very essential to the war effort. And so the effort on the part of some people in the government, both at the national level and in some cities, was to try to ban the private collection of recyclables and to claim that it all anything that people threw away or put out on the curb could only be collected by official state or municipal employees. And the private scrap collectors fought back, and they said, we can do the job more efficiently. We don't need government budget to do it. We'll fund our own activities out of our own resources. We don't use petrol because we work on foot or we have, you know, horse-drawn vehicles. And so they made a number of effective arguments, and they actually succeeded in preserving sort of a dual system. So there, in many places, there were municipal collections as well as private collections. And the government came around and said, as long as you're donating something as scrap to the war effort, it'll reach the factories one way or the other, either through municipal salvage collection or through the private scrap dealers. The important thing is to turn over the material. But it did create a number of it did create tension between private and public. And a lot of municipalities argued that they really could not maintain, they couldn't support their recycling collection if they were competing against private dealers who were only, or who were not obligated to take the less valuable materials. And so this was a constant battle between cities and Whitehall over who was going to really subsidize the recycling program, because it really could not pay for itself if some of the materials were going to the private market and some were being collected publicly.
Okay. Yeah. One of the best parts of this section in the book is where you talk about how the private dustmen, the private scrap dealers, they argue fairly persuasively, especially in, you know, sort of in a discursive environment of, you know, laissez-faire, saying, hey, we know what's good recyclable refuse and we know what's not very useful. It's interesting how the state sort of gets children involved, and the children start, you know, collecting all these tin cans and all these books and all these other things. And women housewives are encouraged to you know, take their stuff and collect it and organize. But there's always this sort of nagging section, especially in the press related to the scrap trade. I believe the journal is called Public Cleansing. You have it a few times in the book. And they talk about, hey, these are amateurs. They don't know what they're doing. You know, it's we're the professionals. We know how to do this. How did this end up? Was it ever resolved?
Well, it's really a fascinating story, and there the gender aspect of this is really crucial. So I think from the government's perspective, the government was really looking for a way to cut costs in wartime, And so they tried a number of things. They initially hoped that the municipal garbage collectors, or in British parlance, the dustmen, would simply add recycling to their list of responsibilities. And this proved to be really difficult because many of them were joining the armed forces. Many were finding better paid employment in munitions factories. A number of them were being called up and drafted, even if they would have preferred to stay working as a dustman. And so the government looked for other people to help with the effort, and people who they wouldn't have to pay. So they looked to voluntary action on the part of women. They approached the women's voluntary services, which was set up on the eve of the war, really with the idea of providing first aid and assistance to people who'd been bombed out of their homes. This was a very large organization that involved hundreds of thousands of women across Britain, who played a really vital role in helping Britain maintain really a civil society in the face of wartime challenges. And so the WVS, as it was known, became a really important part in efforts to involve women in contributing recyclable materials from their own home. And then, as you mentioned, the government also recruited children, both through the WVS, which had a sort of an approach to have women volunteers, then encouraging school children to recycle materials, collect things, but also through the Board of Education, many schools established extensive recycling programs, and then children would bring in materials which would be collected at the schools and then funneled into the war effort. And so this put a lot of pressure on the private scrap trade, which realized that a lot of the materials that they had been acquiring in the past from people's homes, and in some cases from businesses, were now being diverted into this state-run effort that was being carried out by women and children. And so they made arguments, in some cases blatantly sexist arguments, about how, you know, women couldn't possibly know about the intricacies of the scrap trade and all the things that went into it. They argued that they were the professionals, and they often denigrated the women who were going door to door trying to collect material, and they argued pointedly in the pages of Public Cleansing, which was the magazine, sort of the trade journal for the scrap, both the scrap trade as well as the municipal trash collection. They argued that some of the WVS members didn't even realize that there existed a private scrap trade. And so there was one instance, which may or may not be true, but someone who was a scrap dealer alleged that a WVS member had actually come to his place of business and asked if he had any salvage to donate to the war effort. And he straightened his posture and said, "You know, my father before me and I have been in this business for many decades, and we were part of the recycling effort of the country." And he wrote a letter to this Public Cleansing magazine, using this as an argument against the government's reliance on what he considered to be inexperienced and uneducated volunteers.
Okay, and I think this is a good point to talk about what was collected, what did the state want from the civil population of Britain, and what was it used for? You mentioned that they collected paper and bones and metals. And I think before I read this, I knew a little bit about the subject, but I didn't know all the possible uses for these materials. What were they used for, and how did these How did this waste actually turn into weaponry?
Okay. Well, there were a lot of different materials that were essential to wartime. And I think most people immediately think about steel as sort of the important material. And that steel is and was very important for military hardware. And yet that was just one of many materials. The list included rubber, paper, bones could be used for making explosives, waste scraps of fat or vegetable waste from kitchens could be fed to chickens and pigs, which would help make the country more self-sufficient in food production. So just about all of the things that are all the materials that we commonly recycle today were recycled in wartime Britain. But one big difference between the 1940s and today is that we use a lot of plastics today. And plastics were really in their infancy during World War II. And so there was not much consumer use of plastics. And the ones that existed were things like Bakelite, which telephones were made out of. But they weren't the plastic disposable bottles that we're used to today. There were a lot of glass containers. Glass was one material that really did not feature in the government recycling campaigns. It didn't have an important wartime purpose. It wasn't in short supply, but just about everything else was deemed to be important. But one of the problems, and this gets back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the laissez-faire arguments of the private scrap dealers, is that the government really had painted itself into the corner in a sense through price controls and rationing. And so there actually was not a free market in materials during the war. And so some things that were quite valuable to the war effort, the government deliberately prevented the prices from rising to a point that would have made it profitable for the private sector to recycle. And so this led the government to assert that everything was equally valuable, essentially, for the war effort, and that you couldn't really put a price on it. And that was a big part of the sort of the publicity campaign during the war. So the Ministry of Supply, which was in charge of both overseeing the recycling effort on the national level, as well as running many of the weapons factories in Britain, made the claim that tin cans were just as valuable as worn out railroad rails, which were high grade steel, as important as old water bottles and railings in front of people's houses and paper, and they just painted it all as equally valuable. But the problem actually was that some things cost a lot more money to collect. For instance, an old set of tram rails that was buried under asphalt contained very high grade metal, but it was very expensive to dig up the streets and pull these rails out of the ground. And similarly, tin cans, which are actually about 99% steel with a thin coating of tin, turn out to be a real hassle for those who try to recycle them. They're very bulky unless you wash and crush them. They have glue and paper labels on them. They often had bits of food inside of them, which would attract flies and vermin. And even if you collected thousands of them, they didn't amount to very much weight for all the effort that went into them. And then the difficulty of them being a mixture of two different types of metal, tin and steel, posed further problems. And so one of the real difficulties that Britain faced in its wartime recycling campaign was that people noticed that a lot of the tin cans that they had laboriously collected and contributed ostensibly to the war effort were just sitting around in large piles in village squares, in countryside locations. And they quite reasonably asked, well, if the government said that these are valuable materials for the war effort, but they're not actually using them, they're just letting them sit around and attract flies, why should we contribute things that we normally would not get rid of in peacetime, such as the railings in front of our house or the family papers that we've been accumulating, you know, the letters from missionary children or family papers, children's school papers from decades earlier, things like that. And so this was really threatened to be a real problem for the government's campaign. And so at the same time that they were requisitioning materials, and one of the few materials that the government took against people's will during the war was the iron railings. And so there were a lot of people who were quite upset about the fact that they could not say no, or in fact, they could technically appeal the removal, but very few of the appeals were allowed. So there were many cases of contractors showing up, often without warning, and using hacksaws or welding torches to remove iron railings that had stood, in some cases, for over 100 years in front of buildings, and to have those carted away. And at the same time that that was happening, the tin cans that people had contributed were, in many cases, just sitting around in piles. And the technical problem for the industry really was how to strip off the tin and separate tin, which was a valuable material, from the steel, which was also valuable. But mixed together, you couldn't really do anything very useful with it other than make it into a very low quality iron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at this point, I want to talk about Lend-Lease and the United States, because in this chapter, you talk about how Lend-Lease, although it was absolutely vital for the survival of Britain, it was also somewhat of a double-edged sword. The American envoys that were sent to Great Britain are going around around London, looking at railings, old iron railings, and lamp posts, and all kinds of useful civil pieces of equipment in the material world, and are saying, well, we're giving you all these resources. You have to take all this stuff down. Like, you need to make your recycling program even more intensive than it was. And it is really interesting, especially with tin cans, is that Britain, although it's a modernizing industrial power, it doesn't have all the equipment, all the industrial capacity to use all the recycled materials. So there's a point where the British are like, well, we have all this these tin cans, but they're you know, making huge mountains in the village squares because there's no industrial capacity to use them, unlike the United States. While at the same time, the United States is threatening to hoard all the scrap metal that Britain relied on to build all of the tanks and artillery and planes needed to continue the war.
That's a really good point. And the Americans really had a great deal of influence because they controlled the purse strings. And so it was both a matter of the U.S. government wanting to suggest what it considered to be the most efficient way for the British to run their economy. And they made really extraordinary demands for the British to open their accounts and have American auditors come in and look at every penny that was being sent to Britain from the United States for the war effort. And so the Americans insisted that this was the money that they were investing. They wanted to make sure that it went to was spent the way that they wanted it to be spent. But there was also, of course, an important political aspect to this. And the Roosevelt administration faced a lot of skeptics in Congress, both before and after Pearl Harbor, who argued that American taxpayer money should remain in the United States, and it should be directed first and foremost and perhaps exclusively to defending the United States rather than supporting its allies. And so in order to defend itself against congressional criticism, the executive branch felt really compelled to avoid anything that might create political embarrassment on the part of the British and how they were spending the money. And they really wanted the British to publicly demonstrate that they were tightening their belts and using materials extremely conservatively and not wasting any money. And so the one of the things that I found in the archives, time and again, the American officials would make the point that if we in the United States are going to be giving all this money to Britain, and it was billions of dollars in lend-lease assistance, then the British had better prove that they were recycling every bit as much as American citizens were. And so this became a real pressure point between the two allies. And at one point there was a real shortage of non-ferrous metals, which includes everything from aluminum to brass to lead. And the shortage of copper, in fact, was so severe in the United States that in 1 year, I believe it was 1943, the U.S. Mint actually made pennies out of steel rather than copper, because all the copper was going into the war effort. And at this point in the war, the Americans had a number of quite fractious meetings in London with British officials arguing that the British were not doing enough to collect non-ferrous metals from the civilian population. And there were actually plans drawn up to melt down all the church bells in Britain in order to contribute more money for the making of weaponry, more material, brass and bronze and such. And also there were attempts or there were proposals to actually seize things that belonged to private individuals, including statues and trophies and things like that. And it didn't reach that stage, but the American officials insisted that the British had to draw up plans and have a system in place should the need arise for that to happen. And there was some resentment on the part of the British to being told exactly how to run their own war effort and what the British government needed to do to satisfy the Americans in terms of how they treated their own citizens.
Okay. Well, we're getting towards the end of the book, and I just want to talk about two things. I want to talk about, firstly, and it's surprising we haven't talked about it already, is the Blitzkrieg, destroyed, damaged buildings in London, but also in Coventry and a number of the villages on the south coast that had what the British believed as valuable materials, including structural steel and wood, used to make bombs to bomb Germany, strangely enough. And I want to talk to you about the post-war period and the fatigue, recycling fatigue, and the sort of the end of civil recycling in Britain until the contemporary era.
Sure. So in September 1940, the German Luftwaffe started bombing London and other British cities such as Coventry, Glasgow, soon followed. And this caused enormous loss of life and destruction. But ironically, there was a silver lining to it as far as British officials were concerned, because all of this destruction resulted in a great deal of rubble from which valuable materials could be harvested and put into the war effort. Broken bricks were actually ground up and used to make runways for both the British RAF, but also the American Army Air Force when it arrived. Steel, structural steel from buildings could be melted down and turned into bombs or other war material. And so as this went on, there was a conflict between maximizing war production and trying to save buildings that were damaged but could be rebuilt. And one of the really surprising things that I discovered in the archives was a very explicit discussion about the fact that some buildings would need to be sacrificed, even though they could have been saved, they could have been shored up and repaired. Officials took the decision to tear them down so that they could extract the steel from them. And so this led to the destruction in the name of fighting the war of a lot of buildings that it's a shame that they were lost. And this added to the destruction that the German military machine was inflicting on the UK during the war. In other cases, the use of these materials from buildings that had been heavily damaged or destroyed lent a lot of symbolic value to the recycling campaign. So, for instance, when the House of Commons debating chamber was destroyed in a German bombing raid, the press, with the guidance of the Ministry of Supply and the Ministry of Information, made a big deal out of the fact that some of the girders would be melted down and turned into weapons that would inflict equal damage on Germany. And so there's a really important symbolic aspect to a lot of the recycling, and this was one example of this. Moving to the end of the war and the post-war period, there was a real fatigue that set in about all manner of wartime sacrifice and deprivation, and the recycling campaign was part of this. People were tired of wartime shortages. They were tired of the make do and mend campaign. And particularly when they realized that a lot of the effort that they had put into collecting metal cans had been for naught, and they felt a resentment about having lost their iron railings in many cases, there was quite a backlash that happened. And so as soon as the government lifted the mandatory requirements that people send their waste paper or their waste rubber or even their waste string to a recycling collection rather than simply putting it in the trash, and then people jumped at the opportunity to do that. And at the end of the war, actually one of the officials who'd been in charge of food production during the war announced, according to some reports, that he looked forward to having a bonfire as instead of sending his paper to recycling. And he came in for quite a bit of criticism, and then he backtracked and said that he hadn't really been serious. He was just sort of expressing his wish about getting back to the good old days of being able to throw things away. But there was definitely an interest on the part of a lot of people to return to what they saw as the way things should be, which in their view was to be able to freely throw things away rather than say contribute them to a salvage drive. But of course the problem that the British economy and the British government faced in 1945 was that they had invested so much wealth and blood in the war that the country could not afford to waste valuable raw materials even after the victory was achieved. And this problem was compounded for the British when the U.S. government very quickly cut off lend-lease supplies almost immediately upon the Japanese surrender in 1945. And so the mandatory recycling of paper actually continued in many places. And there was also a very strong effort to encourage municipalities to maintain salvage collections. And this became a really contentious issue between the central government and municipalities, who said, well, we can't do it unless we can make it pay. You know, if we're going to be collecting materials at a loss, who's going to support it? Is it going to be the local ratepayers, or is it going to be the central government? And as most listeners will know, rationing actually continued until the early 1950s in Britain. And so this feeling of sort of associating recycling with wartime sacrifice was one that was deeply ingrained, and a lot of people connected in their minds to shortages, to rationing. And this, I think, played a role in making many of the British members of the British public resistant to recycling when it was promoted in the 1960s and 70s and 80s for entirely different reasons having to do with sustainability and environmental protection as opposed to fighting a war.
Okay. Well, Peter, last question. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm continuing to work on the intersection of Britain, environment, and war. And I'm looking at the environmental history of the British military-industrial complex. That's something that a lot of historians have looked at in the case of the United States, but there hasn't been much attention to it in the UK. So at the moment, I'm looking at really what was the environmental footprint, both at the time and in subsequent decades, of weapons production. So the book Waste Into Weapons really focused on what went into the weapons factories. And in my new research, I'm really looking at what came out of the factories in terms of looking at the smokestacks and the drain pipes that emptied into rivers and streams, as well as into the effect that these factories had on the workers who worked in the factories, the soldiers who were in charge of the weapons, and then the wider public and environment, thinking about conventional explosives as well as things like chemical weapons.
Excellent. Okay, well, I think we've taken enough of your time. This has been a podcast with Peter Thorsheim. His book is Waste in the Weapons. It's out on Cambridge University Press, and it came out in 2015. Peter, thank you so much.
Thanks very much, James. It's been a pleasure talking with you.